The first week of legislative session is here. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Lawmakers are off and running for the 2022 session in Tallahassee.
Florida has stood strong as the rock of freedom, and it is upon this rock that we must build Florida's future.
We have redistricting of maps, abortion bills already filed, and a lack of COVID protocols. Also, there are pockets of Palm Beach County that are known as food deserts. We're going to look at a few different urban farming plans that are trying to give those pockets healthier, fresh foods. And finally, some cruise ships are still operating, even though the CDC recommends against it. We'll get the latest from the industry. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Florida's legislative session started this week. On Tuesday, Governor Ron DeSantis gave the State of the State address.
Florida has stood strong as the rock of freedom, and it is upon this rock that we must build Florida's future.
Well, there is a lot at stake for our state lawmakers this year. For one, it's a redistricting and an election year. Bills that affect solar energy, abortion, and where the state's money will go, they're all on the table. To help us understand where we're starting from and what's planned for the session, Mary Ellen Kloss joins us now live from the State Capitol building. She is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. You just heard the clip we played from the State of the State address. Thinking of the speech in its entirety, what was his message to the public?
Well, the governor made a point of being very clear that it's an us versus them situation that we're in. And so he really laid out kind of a landscape for Florida that looks at Florida being better and different and smarter about handling the pandemic. And his quote was, "We were right and they were wrong." And he obviously is steering a lot of the attention at the federal government and a national audience. And that seems to be the tone that he, rather than one that says, let's unite Florida and kind of build a union here, he really focused on the divisions.
And his opponents, and one of them being Commissioner of Agriculture, Nikki Fried, who's running for governor, argued that the State of the State speech sounded kind of like a speech for a hopeful presidential candidate, not a governor. I mean, were his priorities, did they sound more like they were for the state for this upcoming year, or did he sound like a guy who's running for the White House?
Well, this is an election year, and of course, every time it's an election year, we see our leaders focus on issues that they think will be very emotional and activate voters. So this governor's agenda was very much focused on things that are hot button issues that I think he thinks will work very strongly in an election cycle, especially as the Republican legislature drafts behind him as top of the ticket. One of the things that I think was very notable about the governor's speech, however, is that it had so much less to do with Florida and more to do with trying to appeal to a national audience. So he spoke about things like, you know, even though we had no elections security problems in the last election cycle, he wants to focus on election security. He wants enhanced penalties for election law violations. Those are things that resonate well with the Republican base in other states. And he talked about immigration, banning critical race theory. Those are the things that he continues to focus on, even though they're really not the essential issues that I would say everyday Floridians are concerned about.
And it is an election year, and he is running for re-election of governor. Did not say he'd run for president, but the question has popped up about 2024. Video from the Florida Channel coverage, interestingly, showed that if not all of the legislators, a lot were not wearing masks Are there any COVID protocols at the Capitol?
No. I'll be honest with you. There are in some of the committee meetings, they have reserved seats so that they ask people to sit so that they're not sitting on top of each other and space out. But I can tell you that it's a really surreal place to be, given the fact that Omicron continues to, you know, be at a higher point than it has been in the last few months. Democrats, Republicans, staff, legislators, pretty much are for the majority, I would say the majority are walking around without a mask on. And the reason is perhaps many of them have already been infected. Maybe they feel absolutely confident that people are not bringing Omicron into the Capitol. But it's an interesting place to be.
And we've seen that people who have been vaccinated still can get it. We've seen people get it twice. So, you know, lots of questions there. But, you know, that's, again, what we're seeing right now in the Capitol. All right, let's move over to this is, you know, every 10 years we have to redraw the district maps. This is a redistricting year. That's a big part of the process, a big conversation right now. Where are we in that process?
Well, the Senate is moving pretty fast. Today, they are going to be taking up their maps, their proposals for a congressional map and a state Senate map. I expect them to be passed without much friction. There may be one amendment to it by the chairman of the committee. The House is still in its, quote, draft form. They just held a workshop talking about their maps. They don't have final proposals yet, and or even draft proposals that are formalized yet. So this is, the Senate's probably, according to the House Speaker, about 2 weeks ahead of the House. But it's moving without much friction because it's all being carefully coordinated by leadership and with the help of staff. They have worked very aggressively not to give the appearance that they're taking any input from outsiders. They give the impression that they are taking public input, but there has been no acknowledgement that any of the public's submissions or comments have even been considered.
And, you know, of course, with Republicans in charge of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, they're going to have a very big fingerprint on these maps. Do we have any sense of, you know, if they look to favor certain candidates more than others? Where do we see big changes?
Well, the congressional map is very interesting because even the Democrats say that it's a pretty fair reflection that leaves about three districts that are really swing districts, depending on which direction the mood of the voters is. Either party could win those seats. The state Senate map that the Senate has produced is, however, quite a bit more perceived as more partisan, and it puts at least four state senators in the district with another state senator, and all four of those are Democrats. They're not treating Republicans the same way.
I'm speaking with Mary Ellen Claw. She's at the state capitol right now. You can hear there's action going on back there. It's hard to find a quiet place. That's all right. Again, she's the state capitol bureau chief for the Miami Herald. We're checking in with her about the beginning of the legislative session. It's that time of year, 60 days, our lawmakers hashing out the bills. You can find more information about the session and follow her reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. By the way, this redistricting process, Mary Ellen, I mean, getting information, is it easier right now than before, or has it become more difficult? You've been doing this for a while. You've been covering redistricting of maps for a while.
I have, and it's been a remarkable year. I have to say that they are the House and Senate leaders, because they were so slapped so vigorously by the courts in the last cycle, that they are very concerned that any of their statements, that anyone come out with statements that look as though they're appearing to favor a politician or a party. And so they have been really aggressive in trying to tamp down any comments, to the point that they have actually you know, accused reporters and me as well of trying to, quote, pre-litigate or create a legislative record just by asking questions about why they're doing something a certain way. It's remarkable. And I have to say, I think it's having a chilling effect on the kind of open debate that we should see in a legislative process.
And again, we supposedly have sunshine laws and we're supposed to be open and transparent. I wanted to move over to, you know, this other story. This is one that you reported on. We've been talking about it for a couple of different segments now. We looked at last week, we had Floodlight reporter Mario Rizon to talk about the piece that the both of you had worked on, investigated together about FPL and net metering for solar customers, basically when customers sell back excess solar energy to the grid. FPL worked with Senator Jennifer Bradley to file a bill that would make solar more expensive, solar installation for people to use. Where is that bill now?
It's on the fast track. You know, the story got some attention, and it is really a priority bill for Florida Power and Light and others in the utility industry. And even though there has been an enormous amount of criticism of the bill by homeowners who have rooftop solar, by people who are it's kind of a growing industry of installing rooftop solar. The Senate made it clear that they are going to push forward with FPL's priority and gave it a reading on the first day of session, and it passed on a 7-2 bipartisan vote. And I don't think it's likely to get stalled. Now that we are still kind of waiting as to what the House will do. The House sponsor there, Representative Lawrence McClure, has indicated that he wants to see some modifications. So we will wait and see where that goes. But at this point, it's full speed ahead.
You know, we also had FPL spokesman Chris McGrath on the program recently to share why FPL supports the bill. But we talked about FPL writing their blog post after the investigation came out and they published, and it was a personal attack on you. And I wondered, you know, in all your years, is that the way that they handle things, or is this new for you?
Well, I have often been accused of being unfair and biased by FPL. And the sad thing is, I've covered the state legislature for 34 years. There aren't very many reporters that have stayed on a beat as long as I have, and I've seen it all. So, as you know, they have absolutely made no criticism of the facts in the story. They were unhappy with the story, so they attacked the messenger. And that is a tactic that they have become more aggressive about. I found it coincidental that the same day the blog post was posted on their website was the same day that the state attorney's office confirmed to us that three of FPL's political consultants were receiving demand letters in the criminal investigation for the ghost candidates. The heat is maybe on, and I think they want to distract. I really do think that it's just, it has very little to do with me personally or the Miami Herald, but it's an intentional attempt to try to intimidate so that other people don't consider maybe writing stories that really connect the dots and produce a little bit of accountability reporting on this company.
What are the big issues or bills that you're following right now?
Well, in addition to redistricting and energy, there really are some bills that I think are going to deserve a lot of attention. One of them is this move to make it more difficult for local governments to regulate local businesses. There's two bills moving this afternoon in the House and yesterday in the Senate relating to preemption. We will also be covering very closely what the legislature does relating to any condominium reform, disclosure requirements, safety protections for condominium owners. Those are things in the wake of the Champlain Towers South tragedy, we will be putting a lot of attention into.
And I know that there's a redistricting meeting happening soon today.
Right. In 10 more minutes, the Senate redistricting will probably vote out its two maps.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go because you got to get to that. And I appreciate always the coverage. We'll get you back in soon. Mary Ellen, thanks again.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Mary Ellen Claus, State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Follow the session on our website, WLRN.org. She was talking about preemption bills, more preemption bills in Tallahassee. And I want to remind you that we have been looking into this issue of preemption in Tallahassee over the years. And we have a podcast. If you haven't checked it out, Tallahassee Takeover, go to our website, again, WLRN.org, and just look up the podcast and pull it up on your podcast app and let us know what you think about it. Always subscribe and rate, review everything. Well, still to come, we're going to go to Palm Beach County for some elections results. Also a story about expanding urban farms. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, let's go to Palm Beach County. There was a special election on Tuesday this week, a special general election and one special primary election. WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilker Brutus, joins us now to talk about that. Wilker, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lewis. Good to hear.
Great to have you on. Also, by the way, after that, we're going to talk about how urban farms are helping people living in food deserts in Palm Beach County. But let's talk about this election. Wilkin, what happened in the special general election? This is for the U.S. House of Representatives District 20 seat.
Sure, Lewis. With nearly 79% of the vote, progressive Democrat Sheila Surfalis McCormick won the race for Florida's 20th congressional district, filling Alcee Hastings' vacant seat. She defeated Republican challenger Jason Mariner. And with the victory, the 36-year-old Surfalis McCormick became the first Haitian American sent to Congress from Florida. The majority multi-ethnic Black district includes part of Palm Beach and Broward counties. It leans heavily Democratic, and it also has the biggest Haitian community outside of Haiti.
And what's been her reaction from her group?
She had a victory party in Fort Lauderdale, and she has always talked about what it's like to be the daughter of Haitian immigrants and how her win, culturally and politically, is a win for the Haitian diaspora. On Twitter, she said, "This is just the beginning."
All right, let's talk about the Democratic special primary election. This is for the office of State Representative District 88.
Yes, there was another race. Javante Edmonds, a former state aide and a founder of nonprofit Suit for Seniors in Riviera Beach, easily won the state House District 88 seat, nabbing over 65% of the vote. Edmonds defeated former Riviera Beach Police Chief Clarence Williams. Now, if you recall, Lewis, that state House District 88 seat was vacated by the former state representative Amari Hardy, who was essentially required to step down after running for the Congressional District 20 seat.
Hmm. What was the voter turnout like this for this election, for these special elections?
Turnout was low, somewhat as expected. Of the over 161,000 eligible voters in Palm Beach County, just over 12% showed up to vote for the special election. All 182 precincts were completely reported. Vote by mail, according to the county's supervisor of election site, are still being reported.
Mm. And again, you can follow any of the special elections coverage on our website, WLRN.org. Again, talking with our Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, catching up on those elections. I want to talk now about farming. In places like West Palm Beach, Riviera Beach, Loxahatchee, urban farms and community gardens are becoming a staple in neighborhoods in order to provide fresh produce. Wilkin, tell us about Operation No Food Gap Farm, this one in Riviera Beach. What is that?
You're absolutely right. It's definitely a movement. The Riviera Beach Urban Farm and the Restorative Garden is located on Blue Heron Boulevard in Riviera Beach. And anyone who lives in Riviera Beach knows the exact location. It's part of a nonprofit urban farm initiative called Operation No Food Gap, which partnered with the city and local community stakeholders to produce a food forest that aims to address the city's food desert. which means residents there have had a hard time accessing fresh produce in their neighborhoods. And that's where the term comes from, food desert.
And these food deserts, sometimes you have basically neighborhoods that could be miles away from a store, a basic store, a supermarket. Is this a new urban farm?
Yeah, the urban farm is producing more organic, you know, non-GMO food options, cantaloupes, radishes, zucchini, squash, black beans, spinach, carrots, and cucumbers are just some of the fresh produce available at what was once an old fire station lot. And they've surrounded the vegetable garden area with a few fruit trees like cherries, plums, and bananas. And in this new farm, it's aesthetically pleasing. It has walkable areas. There's lounging areas, mural arts, a small children's garden. It's definitely a health and wellness space for the young and old in that community.
Wow. I want to play this clip that you got. This is from a woman named Valika Brown. Let's take a listen.
Well, Revere Beach, unfortunately, has a lot of our marginalized people. And when you think about health disparities, it starts in the beginning of catching it with the food. So we know if we can create access and provide access to healthy foods, then at the end of the day, then most people won't suffer with these health disparities.
So Wilkin, tell me about Ms. Brown. Who is she?
Yeah, so Valika Brown is CEO and founder of eRoadmap Corporation, and her nonprofit runs Operation No Food Gap. And her long-term goal is to address extreme food needs in low-income communities throughout the county by not only giving away fresh produce, but to educate people on how to sustain themselves through fresh produce. And after connecting with Riviera Beach's city manager, Jonathan Evans, and other community stakeholders, things took off. So far, when the fruit and vegetable farm planted the first seed in April, between May and September, the farm gave away close to 4,000 pounds of organic produce to families in the area. And she tells me she plans to expand.
This is really incredible. But, you know, she talked about those long-term plans, you know, for better health for the community and talking about getting food to the community. But is the county addressing this issue at all, or are they just leaving it up to nonprofits and community farms?
Great question. Now, to give you some context about the county, there are about 39 municipalities in Palm Beach County, and each municipality has their own unique needs. The county does have departments dedicated to revitalizing communities and other sort of countywide initiatives, but it seems like leaders and health advocates on a city level are addressing fresh produce needs that directly affect specific neighborhoods. So in this case, it's about the city at this point.
This is so, so fascinating. All right, I want to ask you about another set of farms. This is about a set of community farms in Palm Beach County. The city of West Palm Beach has partnered with Florida A&M University to establish three community gardens in low-income communities. What's the plan for these farms?
Sure. So knowing how to sustain an urban farm is just as important as having one. FAMU, which is an institution known for its agriculture expertise, is bringing community farming techniques to communities in West Palm Beach, not Riviera Beach, West Palm Beach. Mm-hmm. Historically, Black University says they aim to teach community gardening while providing direct access to fresh fruits and vegetables.
Florida A&M, though, I keep thinking about, like, we have all these other universities here locally. Why that connection with them?
Well, the university has built urban farms, family and youth development programs with cities and community-based organizations throughout the state. This is its first agriculture and nutritional training program in South Florida. And so they have their expertise. And so West Palm Beach reached out and they were a perfect match. When I spoke to one of their representatives, she said there is a huge FAMU alumni base in West Palm Beach. So there's a match there culturally as well. Officials felt it was a good match.
And you know what? One of the stories you have coming out soon, you know, you talked to Vonda Richardson about this. Let's take a listen.
We were mandated to improve the economic conditions of those communities and those persons that were underserved, minority communities. Historically, that was our mission. We're not exclusive. We do make that particular emphasis on those underserved and minority communities.
So, Wilkin, other than farming produce, Are they going to have like educational initiatives in these three farms as well?
Yes, Richardson says they're providing research-based educational programs, horticultural knowledge to people in those specific communities. She said an advisory committee will also oversee the community gardens, and this could start as soon as April. So it's going to be interesting to see how things play out.
You have been on the farm beat lately, I got to say. listen, I love your stories. You know, a beautiful way of describing the nature and the experience of being out there in those rural parts of Palm Beach County. Tell me, why do you enjoy covering farming these days? What's going on?
you got me, Lewis. You got me. So in between stories, during my vacation, I even visited a farm called Peaceful Pines Farm in a small rural town called Pine Bluff, just outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. It was the perfect escapism for me. The owners were once Palm Beach County residents. Look, in Palm Beach County, community healing and healthy eating is certainly an important topic during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I recently did a story about music lovers getting together around a fire pit for a traditional African drum circle on a newly acquired farm in Loxahatchee. So we've been talking about Riviera Beach, West Palm Beach, even the western part of Palm Beach County, which is have always been considered quite rural. The discussion around farming has reached the eastern part of the county. And so I guess I'm part of a growing consciousness surrounding health and wellness. And since I'm of service to the community, I had to highlight the handful of urban farms setting roots around Palm Beach County, many of which are aimed at food deserts.
You know, but we're talking about like those food deserts and the communities that just need even the basics. But I'm wondering, with the success of these programs, I'm wondering if you've talked to politicians, do they see this and say, wait a minute, this might work in a lot of places?
You're absolutely right. During the early stages of the pandemic, I spoke to River Beach Councilman Douglas Lawson, and he said the predominantly Black residents of River Beach are also disproportionately affected by what's called food swamps. And food swamps are different from food deserts. Food swamps, the overexposure to convenience stores and fast food, which have led to greater risk of obesity and other ailments. And so there is a targeted effort to combat food deserts and to surround those specific communities with healthier food options, whether it's urban farms, community gardens, or establishing more options commercially and creating better plans with the private sector to make things happen.
I know there was a community that was being built west of Wellington. I think it was even west of Lion Country Safari that was supposed to be built around community farming. And I know this, and I was looking at that community just before the pandemic. Do you recognize the one I'm talking about?
I don't. What's the angle there?
Yeah, no. You know what? It was a brand new community, and it looked like Wellington, very nice houses, but it was supposed to be built around a farm. I got to look into that because I know they were still building it. This was pre-pandemic, and they were still building it, but I don't know if it had finished out. That's something that it just got me thinking about it. So.
Right. I think where you're getting at is, I mean, there is still a lot of construction going on in Palm Beach County. An overwhelming amount of growth is happening in Palm Beach County. And when we're talking about healthy eating, it's not only for low income residents, it's also for people who are making a great income. But specifically for low income residents, low proximity to healthy food markets, low car ownership are just two of many factors that have contributed to the sort of limited access to nutritional food in their specific communities. And that research is according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so there are a number of factors that have contributed to the lack of nutritional options in low-income communities. Higher-income communities have the ability to drive outside of the community to purchase food, to purchase healthier, fresh produce. I do see an overwhelming amount of effort to surround new communities with healthier food options as well.
All right. And I think that the community I was thinking about, I think, is the Arden community. Again, it's just west of Lion Country Safari, and it's a brand new community, but they were building around a farm, and that living there, everybody would take part in this. But again, not your typical food desert type of community at all. Right. Is there any resistance among residents embracing fresh foods?
I spoke to one of the residents in the Riviera Beach area, and he was quite surprised by the amount of support that he has gotten, not only from the younger youth who are a bit more health conscious than the older generation, but he got a huge response from the older generation. He spoke to 75-year-olds up to 85-year-olds who said they saw the urban farm, they walked around it, they got exposed to it, and have told him that they plan to create their own urban farms, or at least a small community garden outside of their own specific neighborhoods. And so this may have longer effects that may reach different age groups. And so you're going to see individual efforts to make sure that folks are eating healthier to combat some of the diseases from the lack of healthy food options.
And with these urban farms too, I'm wondering what residents are paying for this, because sometimes getting fresh food is way more expensive than fast food.
Absolutely. Well, or for these two efforts, luckily they're nonprofit. And that's the beauty behind some of these stories, is that the efforts are from the goodness of people's hearts. These are bona fide community activists who are using their past expertise to make sure that the community grows well, because they are also affected by a healthy community.
These are fascinating stories. Again, talking with WLRN's Palm Beach County and now our farming reporter, Wilkin Rudis. Wilkin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. And by the way, you can follow all of his reporting on our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, some cruises have been canceled. Some are still sailing. A look into the industry's thinking during Omicron. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. COVID-19 is rapidly spreading on cruise ships. Reports of outbreaks and warnings from healthcare professionals are taking us back to 2020, when the virus brought the whole industry to a halt. Now, despite some cancellations, it is still business as usual. By the end of this week, the CDC is set to allow pandemic-era restrictions on the industry to expire. Joining us now is Alex Daugherty. He is a reporter who covers transportation for Politico. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So there was a 30-fold increase of Omicron on cruises. What's been happening these last couple of weeks?
Yeah, so as you said from the top, at their shades of March 2020, we're seeing cruises being canceled. We're seeing reports of, you know, folks being holed up in staterooms for days after testing positive. And folks having trouble getting off ships, you know, when they get sick. But what's interesting is the CDC, in the middle of all this, is relaxing the rules that have been on place for cruises since 2020. Initially, these rules are what prevented cruises from sailing altogether. They were then amended in the summer of last year to allow cruises to start with various regulations in place. And they're going to go away starting on Saturday.
Let's go back to when the CDC set those rules and what was happening in 2020. I mean, the pandemic hits, we go into a shutdown. When did the CDC decide, all right, when did the government decide we can't have cruises right now?
Yeah, it came pretty early on, you know, that there just wasn't the way for public health officials to control outbreaks on cruises and really have a good sense of, you know, what to do when you had, you know, people at sea. A lot of jurisdictions didn't want to take cruises who had infected passengers on board at the time. And there was a lot of questions about, hey, how can you really safely, you know, have someone on a ship for, you know, a few days or even over a week when vaccines weren't available to help fight COVID. So that was the rationale behind canceling cruises altogether, since they were deemed, you know, more of a leisure activity rather than, you know, planes or trains, which had restrictions but have been able to work throughout this pandemic. And so now that the CDC is at least taking away the federal rules that exist for cruises, and their argument is that the cruise companies themselves have been doing, in many cases, exceeding the federal rules that exist. So therefore, you know, it's better to not have these regulations in place at this time.
Okay, so that order is going to expire, and there's no conversation from the CDC about extending it. But with the growing number of cases and hospitalizations, what's being discussed about the future then?
And yeah, this is where I think things get confusing for a lot of people, because the CDC itself on December 30th put the threat level for cruises at its highest level after previously moving it down. And that threat level meant the CDC was recommending no one, regardless of vaccination status, should get on a cruise. That was 2 weeks ago. That hasn't changed. That threat level is still in place. Yet they are actually removing the specific rules that are in place for cruises. And their argument is, hey, the industry is actually doing a good enough job on its own to try and mitigate the spread of COVID on board. Pretty much every major cruise company in the U.S. requires a vaccination to board a cruise, which is not the case, you know, for other modes of travel at this point in time. So the argument is like, hey, you know, there's still things that are going to happen, but there's not much else we can do. And so we don't want to shut these cruises down again because it affects so many people's livelihoods.
All right. They don't want to shut it down, but there have been cancellations. So, I mean, the cruise industry is basically making this decision week by week, or do they have a plan for the future?
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that local authorities may not have some rules. I talked to the public health director from the U.S. Virgin Islands a couple of days ago. She's actually in favor of the CDC's move here. And they turned away cruises, a few cruises over the last few weeks, whenever there's more than 1% of positive cases on board. So those rules by local municipalities would still exist, along with the reporting to the CDC of positive cases on board. That's not going away either. So local authorities, you know, throughout the Caribbean, who, you know, are destination points for cruises, are still going to be able to know, okay, this ship is supposed to come on this day, and they're saying, you know, 2% of people on board have tested positive, or they have not reported any positive cases. So it's not like there's not going to be any government involvement in cruises. It's just the CDC is pulling back the reins.
All right, but again, and you've had a number of cruises canceled. How is the cruise company, Norwegian or Carnival or any of them, deciding they're going to have to cancel a cruise? How are they making that decision?
It's really, at this point, seems to be on a case-by-case basis on their end. If they think that they have the staffing and that it's not an active outbreak, they're going to go ahead. But when, you know, the staffing levels are too low, if too many people are sick, that certainly plays a role. And cruises, as we've seen, that are in progress have sometimes ended early when, you know, too many people on board contracted COVID.
We're not seeing a repeat of 2020, though, right? I mean, even though Omicron is spreading faster than the Delta variant, this isn't looking anything like when the pandemic started.
Right. And the cruise industry itself is arguing that, hey, you know, the trends that we're seeing with Omicron across the country are the same that we're seeing on board ships. You know, most people who are testing positive are not getting sick, are not needing hospitalization. And because in almost every case, crew members and passengers are fully vaccinated, there isn't kind of the same level of concern, you know, with that we have through the country writ large, where there are still tens of millions of people who have not been vaccinated yet.
I'm talking with Alex Daugherty, reporter who covers transportation for Politico, and we're talking about how the cruise industry is faring through the Omicron variant's rapid spread. We saw the whole industry shut down at the beginning of the pandemic. Even with most recent rise in cases, it doesn't look like a shutdown will happen again. But you can find a link to his reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Also want to hear from you if, by the way, you've taken a cruise. We'd love to hear from you. What's it like being on a cruise ship right now? Supposedly these cruise lines have some stiff protocols. Are they following the rules that they've set? You can always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, because I've heard some interesting stories from passengers lately. So, Alex, let me ask you about these protocols. And I wanted to get a sense again what the industry is doing. So they kind of made their own rules, skipping what the state had wanted, and said, we're going to be tougher on ourselves. They'd like people to be vaccinated, or you have to show a test, a recent test, right?
It actually goes further than that. Most of them require vaccination or a specific exemption in addition to testing.
Okay. And what about with their staff, with their workers?
In almost all cases, the workers need to be 100% vaccinated if they're on board ships.
So if someone all of a sudden tests, they show symptoms, they're automatically tested on the ship, right?
Yes, that's the idea. You know, there might be some of the same testing shortages that exist throughout the entire country right now, but the industry has said that they've continued to test folks on board throughout their voyages in addition to tests before they disembark.
And then what do they do when they find somebody who tests positive?
That's a case-by-case basis. You know, the different crews, you know, operators have different rules in place. Most of them involve some form of quarantine, that you're going to have to stay inside of your room, have meals delivered to you and the like. I can imagine spending, you know, days on end in a windowless interior room is probably not ideal. But the cruise industry itself has more case-by-case basis. There aren't, you know, the CDC's guidelines, for example, don't specify in detail, you know, everything that a cruise company needs to do whenever there's a positive case reported on board.
Now, have you been hearing that, though, from folks who've been on cruises that have had positive tests or were on cruises where people had come down with COVID, that the cruise line was following its own protocols?
Yeah, and I've seen, you know, there's a lot of different reporting and a lot of different wrinkles to all this. You know, there's been reports of folks being told, you know, crew members who tested positive that they, you know, need to go back to work. That's been an issue in a whole host of travel industries. Flight attendants have also, you know, reported being told that they're told to come into work while they're sick. That is, you know, obviously an ongoing issue, but not something, you know, there's no written policy, obviously, where, you know, a cruise company is saying, oh, we're going to, you know, have sick people or COVID positive people working on the ships or, you know, not quarantining. But in practice, you know, there's probably times when these rules are not followed or, you know, certain circumstances where, hey, you know, all of our cooks are now sick. We need someone to cook the food. Then what do you do in that case? And I think in a lot of cases, the answer is it's a judgment call.
You know, and I wondered with the workers, you know, how long do they have to isolate if the ship docks? Is the worker taken off the ship? When are they allowed to return? How does that work?
Yeah, I think there's different protocols in place there. You know, I believe their recommendations are with the CDC's recommendations for quarantine. So that would be, you know, 5 days of not showing symptoms. You would be able to go back to work and start interacting people, you know, while wearing a mask, which most employees on the ship are supposed to be wearing masks regardless. So, you know, that, but the case by case basis is really tough because a lot of ports in terms of, you know, where a cruise ship may go during the course of the voyage aren't going to accept that cruise to disembark if there are too many positive cases on board. You know, they don't want their, you know, hospitals overrun or doctors overrun or putting their own folks at greater risk of contracting COVID. So I think in a lot of these cases, it's basically, you know, here's what the numbers are on board. We're reporting that. And then the local officials are going to basically make a case-by-case decision as to what they're going
to
do.
Have you heard of any ships that had to just turn around and come back to the U.S.?
I've seen reports of that, yes. You know, that there's been ships that have not been allowed to disembark, like in the U.S. Virgin Islands, for example, and have had to come back. So that is definitely something that is happening. It's definitely certainly a risk if you're going to go on a cruise, regardless of the actual risk from COVID. You may be, you know, not even enjoying your full itinerary if there's an outbreak. But you know, at this point, like we have said, the government has saying at this point, we're gonna allow people to make their own decisions and we're gonna allow these cruises to continue operating.
By the way, if I'm a passenger and I'm forced into quarantine, I got to sit in one of those windowless rooms, as you said, you know, for most of the trip. Do I get a refund for that?
I believe in most cases you won't, but I'm not 100% sure on what the different refund policies are for different cruises. I know before you were to get on board, if you were to get sick or have something happen to you, that there's options for rebooking your vacations and getting a voucher for that in most cases. I'm not 100% sure, you know, what the different operators might do on board. You know, and I imagine that different circumstances are different. you know, a symptomatic versus asymptomatic case, you know, and how long your voyage might be.
Now, I'd imagine, and I haven't taken a cruise since the, you know, during any of this time, but I'd imagine that when you're buying your ticket, all of this is spelled out for you and that you might be forced to isolate and that you're not going to get a refund. All of it is there in black and white, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, it's a lot of fine print to read, but certainly each company is going to have different policies for all this. And frankly, they're probably looking at these policies yet again, because with Delta over the summer, when they were allowed to resume cruising, the fact that everyone was vaccinated made it a pretty low proposition that you were going to get a massive outbreak on board. Obviously, with Omicron, the situation is completely different. And so, you know, the policies that might have existed when, you know, maybe you're talking a few people here and there testing positive are much different when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of passengers potentially testing positive.
I think about all the industries that have been impacted over these last few years. I'm wondering, the cruise industry may be taking one of the biggest hits. What's happened to the industry financially, especially? How's it doing through all this?
Well, it definitely struggled in 2020. And, you know, a complicating factor here when the federal government was considering, you know, basically bailing out a number of industries at the onset of the pandemic was that a lot of these cruise ships are foreign flagged. They're not technically U.S. ships. And so, you know, in that case, there were a lot of lawmakers at the time saying, hey, we're not going to throw money at the cruises in the way that we're going to throw money at our airlines. So the cruises were in a lot of ways left on their own. And, you know, we're forced to shut down for over a year. So it's definitely been a really challenging time for a lot of those cruise companies. And the fact that they're able to operate now while still having a lot of uncertainty is probably a better world for them than it was in 2020 when the government just said no.
Do you see bookings up or down? I mean, with Omicron, I know that when the cruise lines were starting to reopen, they were saying that the bookings were high, that a lot of people wanted to get back out there. But now with Delta and then now with Omicron, what have you seen in bookings? Are people still willing to take the cruise?
I mean, people are definitely still willing to take cruises. I think especially in the last couple of weeks with the new CDC recommendation not to get on cruises, there's probably a new level of anxiety where, you know, folks who are fully vaccinated and boosted might be taking a second thought at, you know, getting on these cruises, because it's clear that doing this might mean, hey, you may not get that sick, but your trip might be spent inside of a stateroom and not doing the fun things that you paid to do.
So when people are considering taking a cruise, what should they be thinking about? And I'm wondering, too, is there insurance on those tickets just in case?
Yeah, there's definitely travel insurance options. I know they vary in terms of what you get for your buck. Usually that's something, you know, when you go to buy your tickets, you can choose to pay more to have, you know, various levels of travel insurance that will either refund or rebook you. So that's, you know, that's one option. But, you know, at this point, again, once you get on that ship, there's just this, a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, if you test positive, you're going to be quarantining. So that's a risk you got to be, in a sense, willing to take, even if you're pretty confident that, hey, if I get COVID, I'm not going to get really sick.
Mm. Have you been on a cruise, by the way?
I have not.
Okay. Would you?
At this point, probably not. Although I will say personally, I enjoy the snow more than the sun anyway. So cruises aren't exactly my cup of tea.
What? Wait a second. You cover cruises. Did you tell me that you'd rather be in the snow? Come on, man. This is the sunshine state, man. All right, Alex, I'll leave you on that one. Alex Dougherty, again, he covers transportation for Politico. Alex, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I've not given up the sunshine for snow. That's quite all right for me. By the way, again, I still would love to hear from you if you have taken a cruise or if you plan to take a cruise. What are your concerns or what was the experience like? You can always share your story with us. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or join our text club, by the way. You know, you can just text us right now. Text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. 877-677-0767. And you can always share your thoughts about any of the topics that we discuss on the program. But I'd love to hear from you if you've taken a cruise recently and what that experience is like. Is it still fun or is it just too stressful? Well, that's our program for this Thursday, January 13th, 2022. Coming up next week on the program, on Monday, it's a holiday for teachers, but we're going to be talking with a group of them from across South Florida, and we want to hear from you. If you're a teacher, would you still choose to be a teacher if you entered the profession today, if you were thinking about entering the profession today? Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or text us again, 786-677-0767. A panel of teachers coming up on Monday. Also next week, we're going to be talking with Les Standiford. He is our January author for the Sundial Book Club. We're talking about his book, The Last Train to Paradise. You can find us on Facebook. Join the Sundial Book Club. It's free. Just ask to join. Love to have you. If you've read the book, tell us what you think about it. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.